her something of Judy's heavy presence in a forceful turn of her head or the imperious arch of an eyebrow. She stopped wearing makeup. Then she stopped apologizing for not wearing it. Mother charged about $500 for a delivery, and this was another way midwifing changed her. Suddenly, she had money. Dad didn't believe that women should work, but I suppose he thought it was all right for Mother to be paid for midwifing because it undermined the government. Also, we needed the money. Dad worked harder than any man I knew, but scrapping and building barns and hay sheds didn't bring in much, and it helped that Mother could buy groceries with the envelopes of small bills she kept in her purse. Sometimes, if we'd spent the whole day flying about the valley, delivering herbs and doing prenatal exams, Mother would use that money to take me and Audrey out to eat. Grandma over in town had given me a journal, pink with a caramel-colored teddy bear on the cover, and in it, I recorded the first time Mother took us to a restaurant, which I described as real fancy with menus and everything. According to the entry, my meal came to $3.30. Mother also used the money to improve herself as a midwife. She bought an oxygen tank in case a baby came out and couldn't breathe, and she took a suturing class so she could stitch the women who tore. Judy had always sent women to the hospital for stitches, but Mother was determined to learn. Self-reliance, I imagine her thinking. With the rest of the money, Mother put in a phone line. While everyone agrees that there were many years in which my parents did not have a phone, there is considerable disagreement in the family about which years they were. I've asked my brothers, aunts, uncles, and cousins, but I have not been able to definitively establish a timeline, and therefore have relied on my own memories. One day, a white van appeared, and a handful of men in dark overalls began climbing over the utility poles by the highway. Dad burst through the back door, demanding to know what the hell was going on. "I thought you wanted a phone," Mother said, her eyes so full of surprise they were irreproachable. She went on, talking fast. "You said there could be trouble if someone goes into labor and Grandma isn't home to take the call. I thought, he's right, we need a phone. Silly me, did I misunderstand?" Dad stood there for several seconds, his mouth open. "Of course a midwife needs a phone," he said. Then he went back to the junkyard, and that's all that was ever said about it. We hadn't had a telephone for as long as I could remember, but the next day, there it was, resting in a lime green cradle, its glossy finish looking out of place next to the murky jars of cohosh and skullcap. Luke was 15 when he asked Mother if he could have a birth certificate. He wanted to enroll in driver's ed because Tony, our oldest brother, was making good money driving rigs hauling gravel, which he could do because he had a license. Sean and Tyler, the next oldest after Tony, had birth certificates. It was only the youngest four, Luke, Audrey, Richard, and me, who didn't. Mother began to file the paperwork. I don't know if she talked it over with Dad first. If she did, I can't explain what changed his mind, why suddenly a 10-year policy of not registering with the government ended without a struggle, but I think maybe it was that telephone. It was almost as if my father had come to accept that if he were really going to do battle with the government, he would have to take certain risks. Mother's being a midwife would subvert the medical establishment, but in order to be a midwife, she needed a phone. Perhaps the same logic was extended to Luke. Luke would need income to support a family, to buy supplies and prepare for the end of days, so he needed a birth certificate. The other possibility is that Mother didn't ask Dad. Perhaps she just decided on her own, and he accepted her decision. Perhaps even he, charismatic gale of a man that he was temporarily swept aside by the force of her. Once she had begun the paperwork for Luke, Mother decided she might as well get birth certificates for all of us. It was harder than she expected. She tore the house apart looking for documents to prove we were her children. She found nothing. In my case, no one was sure when I'd been born. Mother remembered one date, Dad another, and Grandma down the hill, who went to town and swore an affidavit that I was her granddaughter, gave a third date. Mother called the church headquarters in Salt Lake City. A clerk there found a certificate from my christening when I was a baby, and another from my baptism, which, as with all Mormon children, had occurred when I was 8. Mother requested copies. They arrived in the mail a few days later. "For Pete's sake," Mother said when she opened the envelope. Each document gave a different birth date, and neither matched the one Grandma had put on the affidavit. That week, Mother was on the phone for hours every day. With the receiver wedged against her shoulder, the cord stretched across the kitchen, she cooked, cleaned, and strained tinctures of golden seal and blessed thistle while having the same conversation over and over. "Obviously, I should have registered her when she was born, but I didn't, so here we are." Voices murmured on the other end of the line. "I've already told you, and your subordinate's subordinate, and 50 other people this week, she doesn't have school or medical records. She doesn't have them. They weren't lost. I can't ask for copies. They don't exist." "Her birthday? Let's say the 27th. "No, I'm not sure. No, I don't have documentation." "Yes, I'll hold." The voices always put Mother on hold when she admitted that she didn't know my birthday, passing her up the line to their superiors, as if not knowing what day I was born delegitimized the entire notion of my having an identity. "You can't be a person without a birthday," they seemed to say. I didn't understand why not. Until Mother decided to get my birth certificate, not knowing my birthday had never seemed strange. I knew I'd been born near the end of September, and each year I picked a day, one that didn't fall on a Sunday because it's no fun spending your birthday in church. Sometimes I wished Mother would give me the phone so I could explain. "I have a birthday same as you," I wanted to tell the voices. "It just changes. Don't you wish you could change your birthday?" Eventually, Mother persuaded Grandma down the hill to swear a new affidavit claiming I'd been born on the 27th, even though Grandma still believed it was the 29th, and the state of Idaho issued a delayed certificate of birth. I remember the day it came in the mail. It felt oddly dispossessing, being handed this first legal proof of my personhood. Until that moment, it had never occurred to me that proof was required. In the end, I got my birth certificate long before Luke got his. When Mother had told the voices on the phone that she thought I'd been born sometime in the last week of September, they'd been silent. But when she told them she wasn't exactly sure whether Luke had been born in May or June, that set the voices positively buzzing. That fall, when I was 9, I went with Mother on a birth. I'd been asking to go for months, reminding her that Maria had seen a dozen births by the time she was my age. "I'm not a nursing mother," she said. "I have no reason to take you. Besides, you wouldn't like it." Eventually, Mother was hired by a woman who had several small children. It was arranged. I would tend them during the birth. The call came in the middle of the night. The mechanical ring drilled its way down the hall, and I held my breath, hoping it wasn't a wrong number. A minute later, Mother was at my bedside. "It's time," she said, and together we ran to the car. For 10 miles, Mother rehearsed with me what I was to say if the worst happened and the feds came. Under no circumstances was I to tell them that my mother was a midwife. If they asked why we were there, I was to say nothing. Mother called it the art of shutting up. "You just keep saying you were asleep, and you didn't see anything, and you don't know anything, and you can't remember why we're here," she said. "Don't give them any more rope to hang me with than they already have." Mother fell into silence. I studied her as she drove. Her face was illuminated by the lights in the dashboard, and it appeared ghostly white set against the utter blackness of country roads. Fear was etched into her features, in the bunching of her forehead and the tightening of her lips. Alone with just me, she put aside the persona she displayed for others. She was her old self again, fragile, breathy. I heard soft whispers and realized they were coming from her. She was chanting what-ifs to herself. What if something went wrong? What if there was a medical history they hadn't told her about, some complication? Or what if it was something ordinary, a common crisis, and she panicked, froze, failed to stop the hemorrhage in time? In a few minutes, we would be there, and she would have two lives in her small, trembling hands. Until that moment, I'd never understood the risks she was taking. "People die in hospitals," she whispered, her fingers clenching the wheel, wraith-like. "Sometimes God calls them home, and there's nothing anyone can do. But if it happens to a midwife," she turned, speaking directly to me. "All it takes is one mistake, and you'll be visiting me in prison." We arrived, and Mother transformed. She issued a string of commands to the father, to the mother, and to me. I almost forgot to do what she asked. I couldn't take my eyes off her. I realize now that that night I was seeing her for the first time, the secret strength of her. She barked orders, and we moved wordlessly to follow them. The baby was born without complications. It was mythic and romantic, being an intimate witness to this turn in life's cycle, but Mother had been right. I didn't like it. It was long and exhausting and smelled of groin sweat. I didn't ask to go on the next birth. Mother returned home pale and shaking. Her voice quivered as she told me and my sister the story. How the unborn baby's heart rate had dropped dangerously low to a mere tremor. How she'd called an ambulance, then decided they couldn't wait and taken the mother in her own car. She'd driven at such speed that by the time she made it to the hospital, she'd acquired a police escort. In the ER, she'd tried to give the doctors the information they needed without seeming too knowledgeable, without making them suspect that she was an unlicensed midwife. An emergency cesarean was performed. The mother and baby remained in the hospital for several days, and by the time they were released, Mother had stopped trembling. In fact, she seemed exhilarated and had begun to tell the story differently, relishing the moment she'd been pulled over by the policeman, who was surprised to find a moaning woman, obviously in labor, in the back seat. "I slipped into the scatterbrained woman routine," she told me and Audrey, her voice growing louder, catching hold. "Men like to think they're saving some brain-dead woman who's got herself into a scrape. All I had to do was step aside and let him play the hero." The most dangerous moment for Mother had come minutes later, in the hospital, after the woman had been wheeled away. A doctor stopped Mother and asked why she'd been at the birth in the first place. She smiled at the memory. "I asked him the dumbest questions I could think of." She put on a high, coquettish voice, very unlike her own. "Oh, was that the baby's head? Aren't babies supposed to come out feet first?" The doctor was persuaded that she couldn't possibly be a midwife. There were no herbalists in Wyoming as good as Mother, so a few months after the incident at the hospital, Judy came to Buck's Peak to restock. The two women chatted in the kitchen, Judy perched on a bar stool, Mother leaning across the counter, her head resting lazily in her hand. I took the list of herbs to the storeroom. Maria, lugging a different baby, followed. I pulled dried leaves and clouded liquids from the shelves, all the while gushing about Mother's exploits, finishing with the confrontation in the hospital. Maria had her own stories about dodging feds, but when she began to tell one, I interrupted her. "Judy is a fine midwife," I said, my chest rising. "But when it comes to doctors and cops, nobody plays stupid like my mother." Chapter 3. Cream Shoes. My mother, Faye, was a mailman's daughter. She grew up in town, in a yellow house with a white picket fence lined with purple irises. Her mother was a seamstress, the best in the valley, some said. So, as a young woman, Faye wore beautiful clothes, all perfectly tailored, from velvet jackets and polyester trousers to woolen pantsuits and gabardine dresses. She attended church and participated in school and community activities. Her life had an air of intense order, normalcy, and unassailable respectability. That air of respectability was carefully concocted by her mother. My grandmother, LaRue, had come of age in the 1950s, in the decade of idealistic fever that burned after World War II. LaRue's father was an alcoholic in a time before the language of addiction and empathy had been invented, when alcoholics weren't called alcoholics, they were called drunks. She was from the wrong kind of family, but embedded in a pious Mormon community that, like many communities, visited the crimes of the parents on the children. She was deemed unmarriageable by the respectable men in town. When she met and married my grandfather, a good-natured young man just out of the Navy, she dedicated herself to constructing the perfect family, or at least the appearance of it. This would, she believed, shield her daughters from the social contempt that had so wounded her. One result of this was the white picket fence and the closet of handmade clothes. Another was that her eldest daughter married a severe young man with jet black hair and an appetite for unconventionality. That is to say, my mother responded willfully to the respectability heaped upon her. Grandma wanted to give her daughter the gift she herself had never had, the gift of coming from a good family. But Faye didn't want it. My mother was not a social revolutionary. Even at the peak of her rebellion, she preserved her Mormon faith, with its devotion to marriage and motherhood. But the social upheavals of the 1970s did seem to have at least one effect on her. She didn't want the white picket fence and gabardine dresses. My mother told me dozens of stories of her childhood, of Grandma fretting about her oldest daughter's social standing, about whether her piqué dress was the proper cut or her velvet slacks the correct shade of blue. These stories nearly always ended with my father swooping in and trading out the velvet for blue jeans. One telling in particular has stayed with me. I am 7 or 8 and am in my room dressing for church. I have taken a damp rag to my face, hands, and feet, scrubbing only the skin that will be visible. Mother watches me pass a cotton dress over my head, which I have chosen for its long sleeves so I won't have to wash my arms, and a jealousy lights her eyes. "If you were Grandma's daughter," she says, "we'd have been up at the crack of dawn preening your hair. Then the rest of the morning would be spent agonizing over which shoes, the white or the cream, would give the right impression." Mother's face twists into an ugly smile. She's grasping for humor, but the memory is jaundiced. "Even after we finally chose the cream, we'd be late, because at the last minute, Grandma would panic and drive to Cousin Donna's to borrow her cream shoes, which had a lower heel." Mother stares out the window. She has retreated into herself. "White or cream?" I say. "Aren't they the same color?" I owned only one pair of church shoes. They were black, or at least they'd been black when they belonged to my sister. With the dress on, I turn to the mirror and sand away the crusty dirt around my neckline, thinking how lucky Mother is to have escaped a world in which there was an important difference between white and cream, and where such questions might consume a perfectly good morning, a morning that might otherwise be spent plundering Dad's junkyard with Luke's goat. My father, Gene, was one of those young men who somehow managed to seem both solemn and mischievous. His physical appearance was striking. Ebony hair, a strict, angular face, nose like an arrow pointing toward fierce, deep-set eyes. His lips were often pressed together in a jocular grin, as if all the world were his to laugh at. Although I passed my childhood on the same mountain that my father had passed his, slopping pigs in the same iron trough, I know very little about his boyhood. He never talked about it, so all I have to go on are hints from my mother, who told me that, in his younger years, Grandpa down the hill had been violent, with a hair-trigger temper. Mother's use of the words, "had been," always struck me as funny. We all knew better than to cross Grandpa. He had a short fuse, that was just fact, and anybody in the valley could have told.